I'll try to keep to the time. I have actually have much more material than time, but what I thought I would do is introduce you to a discussion paper that I've written, and I have copies for almost everyone here. Perhaps not everyone, but if you take one per couple, that would help. So I'll distribute that at the end of my talk, so that during lunch, if you see anything in the discussion paper you want to ask me about, then that would be great. I have felt for a number of years that we needed to rethink our social policy in Alberta. I think it needs to be redesigned. That's overdue. Even while I was a minister in church in Edmonton, I became very upset, along with so many other people, about the cuts to social services back in the early 90s with the Klein government. I actually organized a group called the Quality of Life Commission. And we had as among our members Lois Hole and Senator Douglas Roche before he became a senator. And we went into the inner city and listened to people living in poverty, and we became quite upset that people were not able to make ends meet. And this is in the early 90s. And so we haven't had much change to our system since then. So I think it's overdue. And especially when you look at an issue like inequality. And I think inequality is the issue which will drive us to rethink our social policy. Alberta is becoming wealthier. We know that. The GDP is rising. But inequality between the rich and the poor is increasing as well. The latest statistics indicate that the median income in Canada was the same in 2004 as it was in 1982. The Canadian economy as a whole has grown, but it is only those above the 90th percentile who have a significant increase in earned income. Now, this is true of the states, too. And many books are coming out now saying that, well, whereas after the Second World War, there seemed to be a lot of equality. The rich were not so rich way up there. But since the 70s, that has changed. Partly it's because the rich are taxed less. Partly it's just because of political decisions to eliminate social programs, and that's the conservative way. So now we have a situation where there's just an obscene gap between the rich and the poor. I'll give you one example. The wealth of the Walmart founders in 2005 was $90 billion. That's equal to 40% of the U.S. population, 120 million people. That's from a book by Robert Reich, who was very prominent in the Clinton administration. He also says in 2005, the CEO of Walmart was paid $23 million, whereas Walmart workers were paid on average of $18,000 a year. So you can see that the gap has increased tremendously. Paul Krugman, in a recent book called The Conscience of a Liberal, which I really recommend, I have a copy of it here, he writes for the New York Times. He thinks that we're due for a progressive agenda in the U.S., and it looks like that's going to happen if the Democrats get into power in the White House. But he says, he gives a good illustration. He says, okay, if Bill Gates walks into a bar, the average income of everyone in the bar rises quite a bit. But the wages of everyone in the bar except Bill Gates remains the same. So the median income remains the same. And in terms of median income, we haven't improved very much. And so, you know, in Alberta, there's a lot of dissatisfaction, and I think that it has to do with that. People are seeing the tremendous wealth in Alberta, but who is sharing in that wealth? Who is sharing in the Alberta advantage? In fact, people who are on low income, families with low income, are actually not just staying the same. They're falling behind. Income of the bottom 10% actually fell by 18.7% from 79 to 89, and a further 10.7% from 89 to 2004. So poor families, people in low income are falling behind. We might ask why, and some economists say, well, it's just technological change because people are getting more educated, and so skills, they're more skilled, and that drives up wages and so on. So it's all about the market. Others would suggest that, like Paul Krugman, no, it's political decisions. Political decisions have been made. Tax the rich less. In fact, the taxing the rich in the U.S. has gone down from about 74% to where it is now in the 20s. So, change social programs. So governments, in their pursuit of eliminating debt and balancing the budget, reduced progressive tax rates and reduced social programs. And another reason why we need to seriously look at changing social policy is the issue of homelessness that has really captured our attention here in Alberta. I mean, it's obscene, really, to have such a wealthy province and have homelessness. I mean, last summer, the Edmonton's tent city became kind of a symbol of the problem that we face in Alberta. But when I was part of the Alberta Affordable Housing Task Force, which was sort of an all-party task force because there was a Liberal on it, namely me, and also a New Democrat and a Conservative. And we had a lot of experts on it. It was just a very good task force. And we went around the province. We came here to Lethbridge. And we were very upset by what we heard. I mean, the affordable housing is a major crisis in Alberta. And, of course, we heard about the homelessness statistics in everywhere we went. In Calgary, it's just unbelievable. Calgary's homeless population increased between 1994 and 2006. It increased 740%. That's an average 40% increase every 2 years. So it's ironic but tragic that Canada's fastest growing and richest city has the fastest growing homeless population. We coined a new phrase, I think, on our task force because we heard about homelessness, but we coined the phrase the nearly homeless. Because as we listened to people talk about the increase in rents, we realized that so many people are one increase in rent from becoming homeless. So the it's just unbelievable. The reality of homelessness and near homelessness is just a tremendous tragedy. So, and I want to read a statement by Gordon Laird, a recent report that he wrote on homelessness. He writes, Alberta is blessed with a booming economy and record-setting government revenues. Yet the province has neglected welfare benefits, social services, and affordable housing to the point where a huge homeless problem is the only possible outcome. Canada's richest province certainly had the means to address its affordable housing shortage and homelessness crisis throughout the 1990s, yet its leadership elected instead to decrease income supports and download funding responsibilities such as emergency shelters onto the nonprofit sector, all in the name of eliminating a deficit that Alberta's rich oil and gas royalties would inevitably take care of anyway. That's a wonderful statement. I think that summarizes where we've been. So it's time for a change. It's time for a major statement on social policy, a new thinking about social policy in Alberta. So where do we begin? I think the way where we begin is with our values. And we've discussed a lot about this in our Alberta Liberal Party. We have to be upfront about our basic values and vision. Values such as freedom, equality, justice, care, and compassion. I mean, these values are really important. They're paramount in considering what kind of Alberta we want to have for the future. I mean, we're talking about the values of social justice. Respect for human dignity and equal treatment is the foundational value of any social policy. The Canadian Association of Social Workers Code of Ethics advocates social policies that, quote, uphold the right of people to have access to resources to meet basic human needs, that enable fair and equitable access to public services and benefits. I like that statement. I think the whole code of ethics for social workers is something that reflects the kind of values of social justice that I'm talking about. The typical neoconservative approach, on the other hand, is to begin with the values of freedom and individualism, which leads to policy positions of a minimalist role for government. Less government is better government. You've heard that said a number of times by conservatives. Deregulation, free trade, and a welfare system that has turned out to be punitive, creating suspicion and blaming the victim. A social justice approach begins with the conviction that all people have the right to participate in the wealth of the society. Everyone is entitled to a share of the commonwealth of the Alberta advantage. The conservative approach is a champion of equality of opportunity. You know, we give you the opportunity, education, and so on. And if you don't succeed, you're blamed. There's something wrong with you that you don't make it. Whereas what a social justice approach would do would look at equality of results. We have to have programs that actually ensure that people can get out of the vicious cycle of poverty and can move ahead and participate in our society. It's a question of inclusivity. You know, I really like that word. I mean, what kind of Alberta do we want? Don't we want an Alberta that enables, empowers everybody to be included? And so we have to work towards that. Poverty exists not, as conservatives would have us believe, because people do not pull up their bootstraps and work. Poverty exists because of unjust social structures. There must be a paradigm shift and a change in our mindset. What we need is not really a welfare system, but we need a model for social development. We need a social development system where we believe in people and we're willing to invest in people. Social investment in people, that's what we need. Now, I just wanted to say a word about, you know, it sounds like I'm very critical of the system the way it is now, and I am. And I just want to say a word about that system, the typical neoconservative approach, because the Alberta government is not, it's the approach we take in Alberta is not unlike the approach in a lot of other jurisdictions. So the typical conservative approach has really changed things from the period after the war. Before the war, the approach was to provide needy citizens with assistance as a matter of right, and that gave way to the conservative emphasis on workfare. The purpose of workfare or work first programs was to increase labor force participation and reduce social assistance caseloads. So the conviction motivating Alberta's version of workfare was that people on welfare should not be better off than working Albertans. So this led to a severe reduction of benefits after 1990, and actually a 61% reduction in caseloads after 1990. Where they went is a great mystery, because actually the government didn't trace what happened to people after they went off of welfare. The model of service delivery was modified. Instead of social workers dealing with clients in a holistic manner, two types of frontline staff were created: financial benefit workers and employment client support workers. Frontline workers were supposed to follow administrative orders stipulating that clients were only to be issued benefits other than standard ones if they specifically requested them. In response to Premier Klein's goal of reducing the provincial budget 20% over 5 years, the Treasury ordered immediate cuts to social assistance, including reductions to shelter allowance, the elimination of assistance to cover damage deposits, and decreases for school supplies and transportation. Monthly benefits were reduced by 17% for single employable people and 7% for single parents. Clients were required to undergo employment assessments or be cut off. Clients were categorized as able to work, not able to work, preparing to work, and there's recently a new category of temporarily unable to work. Asset rules were tightened, appeals limited, and in general the system became more punitive and paternalistic. And I don't think anything has essentially changed. I mean, there was what appeared to be a change when we had all kinds of people coming to the legislature who had problems with their rents, because landlords were increasing the rent, and the government set up this fund, the Eviction and Homeless Prevention Fund, which originally had 7 million people, $7 million in it. Now it has been doubled, tripled. They can't keep up with all the dollars that they need to help people out. And those people came to the legislature seeking assistance, and they were sitting up in the gallery, and we pointed out, they're here, they need help, what are you going to do? And so the Minister of Municipal Affairs and Housing said, okay, my office is open, send them to me. So they did, they went, they lined up. And what the people who met with them discovered was that their needs were not just about housing, they actually qualified for all kinds of other programs. And so the word came from the minister that, okay, we have to spend more time with people to look at their needs. And that happened. So maybe there's a little bit of change there. But Edmonton Social Planning Council recently reported that in terms of the real value of the money that people on social assistance get, after adjusting for inflation, the real value of monthly assistance benefits since 1980 has dropped by over 50% for families with children and 60% for single adults. And most of this drop has occurred since the 1993 cuts. So we really haven't They haven't gained anything. It's still quite a serious issue. So my pitch is that the workfare approach does not work. It doesn't do what it's intended to do. It doesn't really get people out of the vicious cycle of poverty into the work world. It's more of a disincentive than an incentive. And we need to change. We need to change and look at the rates, the social assistance rates. We need to talk not just about minimum wage. We need to talk about a living wage, because you can't survive on social assistance rates in this province. You can't survive on minimum wage, $8 an hour. You can't survive on $12 an hour. I think Public Interest Alberta, I think they had a meeting last night. I think they would say you need it minimally of $15 an hour to make it in this province. And so we have a whole array of people working in the human resources industry, people working in looking after our most vulnerable children or people in long-term care facilities who are not making enough money to survive. And a lot of them take two jobs, three jobs. People are working in restaurants, people are working in hospitality and hotels. They don't make enough money to survive. So we need to look at the whole area, not just social assistance rates, but also low-income people, because it's not working. The programs that we've had so far are not working. So the workfare model needs to be replaced by a social justice and social development model. As so many researchers have argued, social policies based on inclusivity and treating people with dignity are much more successful in enabling people to move towards self-sufficiency. For too long, the assumption of social policies has been, of course, that the experts have all the answers. What we need is to invest in people, realize that their glass is half full, not half empty. And we have to invest in people recognizing the assets that are already there in the community. I just want to read a quote by John McKnight, who is a guru for social workers, although he's very critical of the social worker industry. He says, "We don't have to have policies that produce dependency. Instead, we need policies that recognize the importance of the right to work, the right to income, the right to real authority, the right to care rather than to be served, the right to tools that allow people to produce rather than to consume, the right to working neighborhoods, the right to working farms, and the right to be free from racism." That's a great statement. I think a better starting point then is to assume that people have the capacity to grow and develop given adequate resources. Gordon Brown, Prime Minister in Britain, his first speech that he made as a Prime Minister said this, and I agree with where he's coming from. He calls himself a conviction politician, and that's an ambiguous term. My wife says, "Well, politicians, they all should be convicted and put away." But that's not what he meant. That's not what he meant. I'll just read you the quote. He says, "Each and every one of us has a talent. Each and every one of us should have the chance to develop their talent. And each one of us should use whatever talents we have to enable people least able to help themselves. And so I say honestly, I am a conviction politician." So he's coming out of a values perspective, which is where I think we should start. "My conviction," he says, "that everyone deserves a fair chance in life. My conviction that each of us has a responsibility to each other. And my conviction that when the strong help the weak, it makes us all stronger. Call it the driving power of social conscience. Call it the better angels of our nature. Call it our moral sense. Call it a belief in civic duty." I think that's we have to call our society back to that, to look at the common good. And you know, we don't hear that expression much anymore. But what are governments for but to deal with the common good and to make our society better than it is now? So my position is that a social justice and social development approach would be a tremendous change. And it's mostly at the level of values and the level of attitudes. And if we could change the ethos, then we can begin to work at improving the actual programs. So the paper that I want you to look at actually has lots of suggestions, concrete suggestions, because I think we need to look at things like the nonprofit organizations. Nonprofit organizations are absolutely important for the social economy, but the problem is that they're not getting enough money to pay their staff a living wage. And so we need to really work at that. We need a living wage policy. I mentioned that. We need to improve the rates for social assistance. We need to make them more rational by tying social assistance routes to things like social assistance rates to things like a market basket of measurement. You know, what does it take in terms of buying groceries and rent and so on for a person to survive and live in Alberta? So we need to have right now there is no rationality to them. Rates go up in a quite arbitrary fashion. Another thing we have to work on is making work pay. People need to have a proper wage, and they need wage supplements so that they can move forward. And I have some suggestions in here. Of course, we need a proper minimum wage policy. We need some tax reform. We need social investment strategies. We need to revitalize the union movement, because unions traditionally were always helped to keep wages up and help those who were suffering. And, unions were always active in the past to bring about a progressive agenda in politics. And I think that can happen again. So anyway, I wrote this discussion paper, and now Bridget hasn't even seen this paper. This hasn't had any approval by our caucus. It's my paper to open up the discussion to see if we can go in a completely different direction. Many say that we have a tremendous window of opportunity in this next election. And that is true. After 36 years of conservative rule, we certainly have a window of opportunity to bring about change. But we also have an opportunity, and this is what really really compels me the most. We have an opportunity to change the welfare system, or the workfare system as we have it now, step by step, to turn it into a system based on compassion and social justice. Thank you very much.